So welcome. Was reading a novel Topeka School last week, and a line caught my eye. Nothing is a cliche when you're living it. And I think it, in one sense, speaks to the way that all dukkha feels special and individualized and isolating, and it's hard to actually see the common themes, common humanity. And it's really kind of amazing how simple our instructions are and how impossible they can feel in moments. How much actually happens when we're basically doing nothing. Amazing how much happens when we're doing nothing. So it's like, oh, to be a scarecrow. And part of retreat is about those moments when it's impossible to find the Dharma, impossible to find a way of practicing. Part of retreat is really vividly experiencing helplessness and then finding help, being found. Retreat is about seeing how narrative and meaning making and thinking function in our heart mind, the kind of dynamics between meaning making and suffering, the complexities in the relationship between meaning making and suffering. The ways we make things with our mind. And sometimes when we make things with our mind, it's freeing, and other times it's confining. And we're here to explore this. And so retreat is about it's about generating energy, intensity, and it's about tranquilizing and distilling energy. And when I use the word energy, I'm not using it in some mystical way. I'm talking about the feelings coursing through our body. I'm talking about the brightness of awareness. I'm talking about the potency of our attention as it grows in the silence, the pregnancy of the silence itself, the kind of the silence seemingly getting louder. And there's so much here, even though things are very seem like not stimulating, but actually in the simplicity, in the non-distractedness, in the pared downness of retreat and of this place, it actually amplifies things. We're not diffusing our our energy through the ordinary kind of pressure release valves and distractions and busyness and, routines and pleasures. And so we start to get quieter, start to get quieter. And samadhi is often characterized as the silence of the mind, whatever the the ceasing of discursive thinking or the kind of attention being thoroughly unified, and that's an aspect of it. But a kind of broader manifestation of samadhi is something like it's like a deepening and a growing sensitivity and a porousness. And in a way, samadhi, makes it easier to love, but also easier to hate. It amplifies and potentizes things. And our attention, the very mechanism of our attention, when we spotlight one thing and leave the rest in the background, what is spotlit becomes bigger, is amplified. Our shared intention and the rhythms and intensities of, just the simplicity of the schedule and the lack of kind of control and say over how the rhythms go. All of this generates a lot of energy, a lot of intensity, and we're trying to hold it all in mindfulness, to feel our way through it. But sometimes the energy that's generated by our practice is more than our awareness can hold. And often we want to give a name to that feeling. We want to give a name to, we want to explain the intensity in our system. And a name is almost always preferable to nameless dread, to use a phrase from an old psychoanalyst. Yeah. Right? And sometimes this is not all negative. Like sometimes the energy and meaning is very positive. It's very positive. There's love and gratitude and these things. And and I'm not here to badmouth love and gratitude, but sometimes you actually can detect like, oh, there's something dysregulated in this energy. There's something agitated. You can feel it actually often on the last day of retreat, where the intensity of what has happened, where the heart's been, gets channeled into this kind of like amalgamation of love and gratitude, and in that is some flavor of agitation often. And then sometimes, of course, it's negative, the kind of intensity of the energy that gets generated. It's like the mind is looking for a placeholder for all of that. And it can seem like problems find me. You know, that sound I don't like, the kind of like it finds me. But it's often better to understand it as a kind of like, the defilements find their object. That makes sense? Like a place to put this intensity, you know, to explain it to ourselves. And sometimes when it's strong, when there's a lot happening in body-mind, it's like we're trying to explain why this moment is so intense and we need a big explanation. And so we sort of pull out the big guns within our head, you know? So we're stirring energy and we're tranquilizing it. We're tranquilizing it. And some of what we're learning to do is to practice without the consolation of words, of stories, to stay awake to phenomena as phenomena, a thought as a thought, not a thought as a description of the world, a sound just as a sound, the intensity in the body just as intensity. And words are strategies we use to get what we want. Words are kind of strategies, the stories we tell. And from this perspective, thinking is coping. It's not that all of thinking is useless or anything like that, but thinking, you can kind of sense this sometimes. Thinking is coping, coping with the intensity of life itself. And as we cope with the intensity, our words try to kind of like match the intensity of the feeling, try to explain it or neutralize it or make it less imposing in some way. And so meaning pulls us in. Meaning pulls us in. It kind of freezes the flow of experience. And we're experimenting with not freezing anything. With not freezing anything. And that means, quite centrally, that we have to learn to work with feeling in a new way. Ajahn Sajito said, if you want to guard the Dhamma, protect the Dhamma, and love the Dhamma, feel it in your body. The Dhamma is then not the ideas or words or expositions. It is the immediate flexion of joy and love in the presence of goodness and of disorientation and sickness that you feel on witnessing brutality, corruption. In the Mula Sutta, the Buddha says all dhammas, all phenomena converge on feeling. All phenomena converge on feeling. And feeling here is vedana, usually translated as feeling tone. And here I'm using it as a kind of almost synonym for what the intensity, for affect, affect in the body, emotion in the body, the sensations in the body that are charged with emotionality, kind of state of arousal. And the world is always impinging on us. We just see it more clearly in the context of the silence and the stillness. But it's always impinging on us, and it is stimulating. The world is stimulating because it stimulates feeling. Experience largely becomes meaningful because of feeling. No feeling, no meaning, no urge to narrate experience, no feeling. There's no sense of urgency, no need to really explain in the absence of charged feeling, less and less need to understand or explain or conceptualize. But this feeling, it's so central in our life, in our motivation. When we think about our life, we're thinking often about, you know, like, how are you? That's a question about how we're feeling. When we think about our history, we're often, our autobiography is knit together by chapters of emotion. And feeling is at the heart of the Buddha's concerns, you know, beyond sorrow, grief, and lamentation. The First Noble Truth, dukkha, there is dukkha, that is usually rendered as suffering, but often as dissatisfaction or stress or anguish. In other words, the First Noble Truth is about feeling. The researcher, Lisa Feldman Barrett, she says, interoception, kind of awareness of inner life. Interoception is usually experienced as the affective properties of valence and arousal, suggesting that all psychological events exist in affective space. Valence and arousal might be better thought of as properties of consciousness rather than properties of emotional episodes per se. Valence and arousal. Valence, pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, almost always falls to one, you know, even if very subtle, subtly pleasant, subtly unpleasant. Valence, and then arousal, the sense of like something is being activated. Right now, something's being activated. Maybe intense or subtle. You may have a kind of strong need to narrate it and understand it, explain it, or maybe very weak need. And the path is about peace in a way, which is maybe we say it's the peace is maybe the cessation of valence and arousal. A mind essentially unstimulated by phenomena. But in order to find our way through to peace, we feel a lot of feeling. And it's not like there's a hierarchy of like, okay, you're supposed to get to peace or something. One of my teachers, Shinzen Young, would say, not a scintilla of preference between the eruption of enormous, you know, valence or peace. We usually try to sort of pacify ourselves with words and story to cope, to soothe. And a little maybe like a baby sucking on a pacifier, no milk, right? But still soothing. And maybe a lot of our thought is kind of like that. And so the question, like, how can we soothe ourselves? How can we hold the intensity? How do we tranquilize these states of arousal without resorting exclusively to storytelling? What brings soothing, reassurance, tranquility. So as practitioners, we really become connoisseurs of attention. This is, you know, quite central in the Buddhist path, how we use attention, appropriate attention, yoniso manasikara. And we experiment with this. So we experiment maybe first with the aperture of attention, how narrow or wide it is. So sometimes it is it's very soothing to make the aperture small. The very sense of, you know, the Buddha said attention brings things into existence. I don't think that's disputing the reality of the world, but attention brings things into existence. So the more we are aware of, the more it actually sometimes can feel like life is collapsing in on us. And so sometimes it's not avoidance strategy just to narrow the attention. This is what we're doing in part with the breathing. The sense of too muchness happens when it feels like we're just being inundated by too much. And so part of the soothing quality of this kind of narrowing is there's less and less, there's really, in a sense, from the level of experience, there's less and less world. There's less and less world. And then it collapses into just the breath, maybe, or just the feeling of care, or just the soundscape. And so we become secluded from the busyness of samsara, like the busyness, you know, by directing the attention and soaking the attention, vitakka vichara, directing the attention maybe to the breath, wherever we choose, somewhere. Aiming the attention and soaking, staying with that, having a kind of intimacy with that particular experience. And we're not suppressing anything, but the attentional spotlight gets smaller and smaller. And so the sense of the intensity, the relentlessness of the world, the kind of way in which just being human is a little overwhelming. Our world gets smaller in a good way. Other times that doesn't feel soothing, but actually intensifying, because the attention will get brighter and brighter as the aperture gets smaller and smaller. And so if I'm in bed, you know, awake on retreat, trying to go to bed, I do not follow my breath, you know. Like, okay, we're gonna, the aperture, what's skillful? So we make it wider. Maybe we open our eyes to the visual field or the soundscape, just like it kind of conveys some sense of like the expansiveness of awareness, to be open, wide with sound. And not just sound, but silence, to actually try to hear the silence, not just to kind of hear the absence of sound, but it's like we attune to the silence. Even if there's noise there, we attune to the silence here. And so we explore this kind of attention, but sometimes the spotlighting function of attention is itself fatiguing. That sense of being the spotlight operator that's in charge of directing the attention to the breathing or to sound or to the visual field, that itself is fatiguing. And meditation techniques generally rely on the spotlighting function of attention, but awareness can't have a technique. Awareness can't have a technique. If I asked you to stop being aware, you couldn't do it. And whatever you can't stop, just rest there. This kind of orientation is essentially reducing the effort, the energetic effort of attentional spotlighting. Right? So there's a little bit of, you know, we could say like attentional caloric burn. You know, whatever you, somebody walks for an hour, they burn 300 calories. They run, you know, it's 700 calories or something. Like, okay, what's the attentional caloric burn of meditating? Of directing the attention to the breathing or to sound or something? And is it possible actually to get the attentional caloric burn down to something like zero, but still be very awake? And so we experiment. Are there ways of practicing when the spotlighting function of attention just feels like too much? Are there ways to be awake without burning any attentional calories? Shinzen Young used to have a practice called like do nothing. And the basic instructions were, let whatever happens, happen. Whenever you're aware of an intention to control your attention, drop that intention. Let whatever happens, happen. Whenever you're aware of an intention to control your attention, drop that intention. So if you have the intention to get focused or settled, drop that. If you have the intention to stay with a good state or fix a bad one, drop that intention. If you have that intention to be clear or concentrated, equanimous, drop that intention. If you drop into equanimity, good. If you notice you're trying to find or maintain equanimity, drop that intention. If for a while you have no intentions to control attention, good. Just hang out for as long as short, or short as that lasts. If you get confused, let go of any intention to do something about it. Start to get the idea, you know, It's like you're it's not that there's zero effort, but like all the ordinary machinations of egoic striving are pulled out from under us here. All the kind of routines of self-improvement or something like this are, we're robbed of them here in doing less and less. And it's much more about what we stop rather than what we pick up. And in that kind of practice, we will get lost. And actually, that's not the enemy of a practice like that. It's not to like, okay, shake it off and now I've got to get back to clarity and equanimity or something. Like, no. It's sort of like this radical relinquishment of intentional marshaling of attention. And this is a kind of, this is not the practice we do all the time or something, but there's this is a kind of counterbalance to that intentional attention spotlighting. Our kind of metabolizing the intensity, all this feeling is supported by these different approaches to it with attention, awareness, also we come into deeper tranquility as faith is awakened in us. Kind of confidence. And that word to speak, you know, approvingly of faith, it's you know, I'm surprised to be doing that. But the faith that we speak about in this context is not filling the unknown with self-soothing certainties. But the way Sharon Salzberg put it, she said, is like trusting the implications of your experience. Beginning to trust your experience. And when faith is born, faith in this path, something very deep in us relaxes because we're no longer trying to confirm that we're doing the right thing, that we're a good yogi, that we can do it. It's like, in a way, we don't even care. Those questions are besides the point. We know we've like touched into goodness and we've got to follow it no matter where it leads. And that itself is relieving, soothes some of this intensity. And so faith, maybe we can say faith is in a sense is faith in goodness, that we partake in it, can follow it, can be developed. And then this kind of, we're stirring the energy and tranquilizing the energy. And we part of how we tranquilize the energy is the practice of equanimity. Equanimity being not shedding all preferences, but the compulsivity to enact our preferences that dissolves. And so we relax body and mind, muscles and judgments. We begin to actually open to the First Noble Truth that there is dukkha. Equanimity is often described as a kind of like the balance point between suppression, avoidance on one hand, and entanglement, rumination, enmeshment on the other. And so, as we begin to open to the First Noble Truth, you know, which sometimes I feel like contains the other three, but as we begin to open to the First Noble Truth, like, oh, suffering will not be banished. That actually relaxes the part of our heart that is forever looking for the alternative world that Max spoke about. And so we're learning, as Shinzen Young says, not to fight with ourselves at any level. What would that mean for you, not to fight with yourself at any level? This is how intensity is soothed. And so we develop equanimity with longing. You know, getting is always different than wanting. We develop equanimity with longing, because we're just less seduced. We kind of know intuitively that the objects of our greed overpromise. And that's different than desire. But to really understand the difference between craving and desire, equanimity is needed. So equanimity with longing, a very tender. And then aversion, the intensity that comes along as aversion. We develop equanimity with imperfection. That something is always wrong, going wrong. And so we let the kind of flow of feeling wash through us and sense how it's sort of like kneading our body-mind like dough. That's the feeling of equanimity, of purification, of tranquilizing feeling, is like something in us is being kneaded like dough. And so retreat is about, I said at the beginning, about stirring the energy and then distilling it, tranquilizing it. And here I'm suggesting that we're doing this without using our words exactly to cope. But then again, stories have their place. A story-free life is unimaginable. A story-free Dhamma is unimaginable. Martha Nussbaum said, you can't really change the heart without a story. And we are here at the Insight Retreat Center, and insights are a kind of little mini story, that is born out of the silence, born out of our willingness to cope without words. And the nature of insight is that it feels like it's in the bones. It feels so embodied, so close to the heart. And we get good at distinguishing like those words that are very close in, very experience near versus experience far. And the kind of basic flavor of insight, the flavor of those mini stories, is freedom. It frees something in us. It's self-evident. This is freeing. And we revel in that, we abide in that when there is that. The little mini stories of insight that free us. And we know that no story lasts forever. What was empowering can become confining. What was fresh can become stale. And in a way, we become kind of connoisseurs of our own stories. A lot of what Dharma teachers do is just like nudge people, like, okay. Maybe you're done with that story. And we drop into the kind of non-conceptual realm of intensity, of embodiment, of arousal and valence. And we become undefended in that realm. We're not intent on coping with our words. And then a new mini story, a new insight, a new way of understanding bubbles up. A little richer, a little freer. And then we stir the intensity again. The process repeats. And we keep going till we're more and more free. Just breathing for a moment together here.